efforts to provide access to science and technology to underrepresented groups. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11, From the Vault celebrates the 50th anniversary of the Pacific Radio Archive recording from 1968 with Martin Luther King, Joan Baez, Muhammad Ali, Allen Ginsberg, and more. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. The Finance Committee meets this month on August 23rd at Cider Riot at 807 North East Cooch.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Black on Black Startups from the Ground Up on Saturday, August 18th at King Elementary School in Portland. Black on Black Startups from the Ground Up is focused on Black businesses and Black spaces and is hosted by the 2018 Black Male Achievement Summer Youth Experience Cohort. Again, that's Black on Black Startups from the Ground Up on Saturday, August 18th at King Elementary School, 4906 Northeast 6 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage underneath Community Events.
Love is but a song we sing, fears we will die. You can make the mountains ring or make the angels cry. Though the bird is on, returns for us at last. We are but a moment's sunlight fading in the grass. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together.
Sisters and brothers, welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in the Portland area, 104.3 FM in the Willamette Valley, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia River Gorge. Or you can hear us on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. And if you feel like it, you can hear some of our older shows on kboo.fm/Veterans Voice, which is one word, Veterans Voice. I'm Marvin, and I'm going to be talking about several different things today. And I really enjoyed Ani and Teresa's show this morning, and I think it's very, very important about the things they were saying and the problems this country's going to have. And KBOO's really, really important when it comes to getting the information out when the other shoe drops and hits the floor. Aretha Louise Franklin, 1942 to 2018. Boy, when I was in Vietnam, her song Respect was so popular with the black guys and us white guys. You could hear it on Armed Forces Radio, and you could also hear it back at the rear areas, where guys playing it on their stereos and their record players, Aretha song. And when we came back in from the field, what was called stand down, we'd come and stand down, we'd get, you know, take a shower and get some hot food and get re-armored up, and sometimes we'd even get some different clothes to wear if there were any. And the guys would play songs, you know, and one of the first songs that they played was Respect by Aretha. And it's really, really a good song. And every time it starts, I start dancing for it, and because it brings back some memories for me. I remember I saw Fillmore West, Aretha played. And when she walked onto that stage, that whole building erupted, you know, because she came out on that stage. She's just like this huge hurricane, you know, comes off, man. She brings it, and she started her show off with that song, and it was so great. People were dancing in the, you know, and having a great time, and you know, I liked it. I had a good time. Last Saturday, I believe, KBOO had our 50th anniversary block party. And I was there. I was only there for about 45 minutes to an hour. But I saw a lot of people I hadn't seen in a while. You know, I saw Kathleen Stevenson. And that was really, really great, because she fought for this show, you know, to keep this show on the air. And then her and you, the listeners, you know, kept the show on the air. This is our 27th year, going on 28 years. And when we first started, we thought, well, as soon as this Gulf War is over, first Gulf War is over, that, you know, we'd go back to doing what we were doing. And none of us, you know, that just didn't happen. And all of us, you know, men and women, veterans of different wars and stuff, we just stayed on and kept doing stuff. And you know, I heard today somewhere that Americans for 17 years they've been in Iraq and Afghanistan and those places, and 17 years, you know. And just the other day, a special forces trooper got killed, you know. And it just keeps on and keeps on and keeps on. And some guys got killed in Africa, you know. They just keeps going and going and going, you know. This country's been at war its whole time. There's never been a time when this country hasn't been at war and had its troops in some country. And it just keeps on going, you know. And who pays the price? Poor working class people, that's who pays the price. And You know, they get that flag out and they start waving that flag, and boy, there's some people just hop to it, and then they bring the draft. They don't have it right now, but you know, guys still have to sign up when they turn 18, so they got that whole list of people, you know, when they need it. With this fool, dangerous fool in the White House, you just never know with this guy. And, oh, yeah, he's the guy that did everything he could to stay out of Vietnam. And he'd got all those deferments for school. And then when those ran out, he found some doctor that would give him medical deferment because he had heel spurs, which was at that time considered a minimal medical deferment, which means that he could have came in the military and they would have taken care of him, and there's nothing to taking care of him, and he could have, you know, been on the army, and he could have been over in Vietnam with the rest of us guys, you know. But he chose not to, and now he's sending guys off, and women, I'm sorry, men and women, off to these other countries to fight these wars. And, you know, he had his chance to go and he didn't go. So, you know, I really have a problem with him. And not just on that, but on a lot of things, I got a problem with him. And but, you know, one of the things, he had his chance to go and find out what war's like, and he didn't do it. You know, and then he comes, wants to have this huge parade in Washington, and military parade, I'm sorry, and Pentagon, you know, they pretty much said, that doesn't make any sense. So this morning I heard where he said that, well, we're not going to have it this year, maybe next year. And it went from $12 million to put it on to $92 million. So, you know, just so he can get his, I don't know, having a parade, military parade, just for this one guy. That just doesn't make sense to me. Also, on July 30th, a really wonderful man passed away. His name was Ron Dellums. And Ron Dellums was in the Marine Corps from 54 to 56. And then he served in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1991 to 1999. And he was from Berkeley. And he was definitely one of us, folks. And he fought for working class people, you know, people of color and LGBT community and everything. And I remember in 1971, Vietnam Veterans Against the War had a huge anti-war march in D.C. I mean, it was huge. And in front of the march were veterans and active duty soldiers. And there was a bunch of active duty soldiers there. And it was huge. It was a huge rally. And all through that week, you know, there were things going on. And a lot of people don't know, but the police, you know, kind of got out of control at that one, too. And they rounded up people that were on the street, and they put them into the football stadium. And one of the people who got arrested was one of my friends, Linder, his wife. So he didn't know where his wife was for a couple days, you know. And they just rounded up people. And that was a huge problem. And that's when we marched from there. We marched over to the Pentagon. And the Pentagon, boy, they had their troops out in force. And that was pretty. We blocked the bridge down, and oh, it was really something, you know. And what's so good about that march is that we threw our medals back, and we threw our clothes, you know, our jungle clothes, you know, back at them, and it was just amazing to see how many of my brothers were there throwing their medals and things back to the government. And John Kerry was one of them there, you know, and he threw his medals, but he changed quite a bit. But he still did support the veterans, and he still was anti-war, and he voted for Iraq, I'm not sure. But at that time when he was there, he wasn't one of the leadership, but he was a good speaker, and that's why he got to be the speaker for VVAW. Our buddy Brian Wilson, he was there, and he didn't really, he had had a falling out later with John Kerry. But the guy you don't hear about a lot is Bob Kerry. Bob Kerry, a Medal of Honor winner in Vietnam. He lost part of his legs. He was a Navy SEAL, but he's really liberal. And I remember him talking about when they took him to get his Medal of Honor, he really thought about not going up there because he did not like Richard Nixon, like the rest of us. We didn't like Richard Nixon either. But Bob did go there, and he did get his Medal of Honor, but he was really outspoken. And he's another good guy. And but Ron Dellums, at nighttime we were camped out all over D.C., and Ron Dellums and Teddy Kennedy and some of the World War II guys in the Senate and the House would come at night, and they would talk to us, and it was really pretty interesting talking to these guys and the things they were trying to get through to end the war in Vietnam, and they were pretty good, And so I really when I heard that Ron Dellums had died, Ron Dellums was African American. And that's what I was going to talk about, that. When we had the march in 71, it was made up of everybody was out there, There were women and men and children and people of color, and everybody was out there against that war. Older people were out there. I was just amazing how many people were out there against that war in Vietnam. And it was just great. It was great. And that's what I'm hoping we'll see now with what's going on now. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but I'm kind of going down in order here. And I want to talk about some other things. But I was listening to the radio, and I heard that the Saudi coalition had hit a school bus in Yemen and killed 40 children. And the big to-do about that, and it was a big to-do, it's a horrible, that war's been going on for I don't know how many years now, and children and old people are dying, from wounds and some from diseases, and that's another war. And who's supporting that war? Who's supporting that aircraft? Who's supporting those bombs and bullets, And that's the U.S. The U.S. is doing that. And 40 children, boy, more than that have died over there, but 40 children at one whack, that's pretty horrible. And that just sent me right back to Vietnam, and I was thinking about all the poor children who were killed in that war. It's just horrible. Kids from the South, Southern Vietnam, and children from Northern Vietnam. I saw this picture, I have it somewhere at home, and it's a picture of an older man, he's probably in his 80s, and he's standing in front of a building that had been bombed during the Christmas bombings in Vietnam, and the place was just destroyed, and beside him, another man and a woman were walking, and in their arms was their child who had been killed. And they were walking, they were going to walk behind this guy, and there were people in top of the, digging through all the, bombed out buildings looking for people and everything. And this guy, he was looking right at the cameraman, and he had this look on his face that was just hate. Just hate, from these, the bombings Boy, it was. I saw that same look on the faces in the South, you know, with their homes getting burned down by Zippo lighters. With, you know, their homes weren't much, but then they would get burned down, and their crops would get destroyed. Their rice would get destroyed. I'm just as guilty, but I didn't do that stuff. You know, I just didn't do it. I was there, but I wouldn't do it, you know. And the women and children would be separated from their husbands and grandfathers and all that, and interrogated and everything. And you could see that same look on those people's faces, you know, at us, just the hate on their faces. That here we were supposed to be going over there and helping them, but here we were, you know, just destroying their country. And more people were killed by American bombings and American artillery fire. So, you know, and just like happens in all wars, that the innocent people take the brunt of the battles, and there's nothing much you can do about it. They can do about it, you know. And the Saudi coalition, boy, why are we helping them? And we all know why we're helping them, because they got oil. So that's why we're helping those people. And that's so horrible. And I want to talk a little bit. I'm sorry I'm bouncing around here a lot, but Ani and Teresa's show was very, very interesting. And I listened to it and really listened to it. And I was down at the waterfront also, and I actually saw Teresa down there, but I didn't get a talk with her because I was going somewhere and to be with some, meet some people. And you know, American fascism, that's what it is. I mean, I heard people call in, and, you know, but if we don't confront these people, they're just going to get bigger, and they're going to get more violent, and they're just going to grow if we don't do something. That's like in Germany, you know. You could see pictures of the brown shirts marching as they started their power grab. There were not that many of them, you know. They'd march down the street, and not many, many of them were, you know. And then they grew and they grew and they grew and they grew because nobody, I mean, people, you know, was against them and everything. Don't get it wrong. But a mass majority of people didn't. And they just kept growing and growing and growing. And look what happened, you know. The same in Italy. I had my father and four of my uncles all fought in World War II. Some of them fought in Europe against the Nazis and against the Italian fascists, and some in the Pacific against the Japanese fascists. And boy, if they were alive today and they saw those Nazi flags flying, boy, they would not be happy. You know, and I look at and I see those Nazi flags and I think, boy, what these American people aren't thinking right. They are, you know, these guys will spread and spread and spread and spread and spread. And back in Tennessee, I was part of the anti-Klan movement. And every time you saw a Klan rally, you could throw a rock at the Klansman and it would bounce off of him and hit a Nazi. So even back in the 70s, they were together. The Nazis and the Klan were together. Back in Tennessee, these people, these Nazis and these Klansmen would march in children's Christmas parades. You know? and they were armed. Those people were armed. And these guys here, they're armed too. You know? They're not there to shake our hands, and they're not there to pat us on the back and join us, you know. They're not there for that. These are vicious Nazis, and they're vicious Klansmen. You know, the one thing in the South, when we would, I had two of my best buddies were both black guys, Danny and Frank, and they're the ones I traveled to North Carolina with, and they're the guys that we always were together, and we would go to these anti-Klan rallies. In Tennessee one time, there was this trial going on down in Georgia, I believe it was Georgia. So Danny and Frank and I and Frank's sister drove down there, and the trial was about a black kid supposedly had raped a white girl, and he supposedly rode his bicycle to where she was at and took her behind the train station or something. And this kid, he couldn't think. He was, his intelligence was that of a 5 or 6 year old, you know. And there's no way that kid could rode a bicycle. And they were going to have this trial for this young black kid. And in the jails, he was being beat up and being sexually assaulted by people in the jail. And the week before that, there was a march against it, and the Klan and the Nazis and the marchers got in a gunfight there in Georgia. And when we went down there, I think it was a week later, there was going to be another march, and most of the people in that march were black. Most of the people in that march were black, and the white community was also there, but the majority of the people were black. And it was really good. I remember as we were in the march and we came to this cross street, and Danny says, well, this is where the Klan shot at us last time, but there were no Klansmen there, and there was no police. I didn't see any police. And so we got to where we were going, and I was standing back, and Danny and Frank went up front because they were going to talk. And I was standing in front of this house, and this older black woman was standing there looking out the front porch, and she looked at me, and she said, uh-oh, there's going to be a shooting, you know, thinking I was going to do it. And then when the rally was all over, the guys came back and with their friend who lived there, and we went into this house where this the older woman had said that, and she just looked at me, you know, and went, huh. And she gave us this wonderful meal, just this wonderful meal. But in the South, you know, when before they started really having the marches and everything, Dr. King and everybody was there, that the Klan pretty much ran wild. And I talked to Danny and Frank about it a lot, and they were saying that, you know, black folk, they said, didn't just stand around and let it happen. You know, they fought back. They fought back against those people that were killing them and beating them. They fought back. You know, they just didn't stand around idle. They fought back. When you're attacked, you fight back. You know, that's what they did. And American fascism in this country has got to be stopped. It really has. It has to be stopped. Because we can't allow these groups to just do whatever they want and spew their hate. And they do hate. They hate gays. They hate the Jewish folk. They hate, you know, anybody that's not what they believe in. And I know this because I was part of the anti-Klan movement in the South, and I know how they think. and they are not peaceful people. I'm telling you. You know, I was looking at the rally last week, or week, you know, I can't really remember, but I was looking at it across the way, and these guys were over there, and if you really want to, if look at their hands, sometimes what they'll do, if they think they're going to get into a fight, they'll put like duct tape and wrap their hands up like a fighter does before they go into a, you know, put their gloves on. That's what they'll do. They put duct tape around it, their hands. And so, you know, there's a few of the guys over there had that. And Teresa and Ani and other folks were right. The police had their backs turned to the fascists and their fronts turned to us. And we outnumbered the fascists by a lot, you know, by a lot. And they were protecting the fascists. There's just no doubt about it. And I was standing there when the police attacked on the street. They attacked those guys, you know. And I didn't see anything flying through the air until after the police went after them. I didn't see anything thrown, and I was watching them. Where I was standing, there was this little park area right behind me, and the cop line had moved up a little closer. And the guys that the police, and they had the orange kind of I don't know what you call it, orange thing wearing around them, and those are the guys that had the guns that fired the tear gas and stuff. And one of the guys was, I was standing there, and he was screaming, and the look on his face, he was a white guy, and his face was red. He was angry, and he was screaming at these folk that were just standing in this park. And he was mad. He was screaming at these people. And I thought, oh no, man. So I walked and stood right in front of him, and hoping that would calm him down, that he wouldn't fire at me or over my head at those kids in that park. And all of a sudden they backed up. I don't know, their sergeant or something told them to back up, and they had backed up. But this guy, he was angry. He was angry. And boy, the look on his face. Woo. Do you want to go ahead and play that second song for me? I want to play another song. I have him play another song for me. And he has a choice to play number 12 or number 13. It doesn't matter. So you want to go ahead and play that for me, please?
Do you feel good? Do you feel real good? Good enough to help me sing this next song? Oh, I bet you don't even remember it. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.
To your change, 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 change,
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Oregon Symphony, located at 909 Southwest Washington Street in downtown Portland, presenting Gary Trudeau, political cartoonist and creator of Doonesbury Comics, sharing from his latest book, Sad, Doonesbury in the Time of Trump. Tuesday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets and more information are available by phone at 503-228-1353 or online at orsymphony.org. And now back to Veterans Voice Radio.
Aretha Franklin, boy. What a voice. Boy, what a voice. And she was, you know, she was part of the movement, you know, the black movement, and bless her soul for it. You know, she did great. She did wonderful. But I want to get back to the park, you know. The police, you know, are the front line for the rich in this country. You know, they're the front line to keep things settled, you know, to keep things settled and keep the people set, you know, from getting what, you know, what we deserve, what's rightly ours. And if you think that the police are your friend, you know, just look what happened down at the waterfront. And every time we have something go on, the police attack us, and they don't attack the people that are really causing the trouble. And I just wish that more black folk would come down and be with us, and so we can have this huge, you know, coalition of everybody down there, you know, because those Nazis and those Klansmen will go after our friends in the black community. There's just no doubt about it. You know, they hate people of color, you know. They really do. You know, one of the sad things I saw was at a Klan rally was that we didn't go into it. We were far away on a hill looking down with binoculars watching them. And there were little bitty kids in Klan suits or whatever you want to call it. You know, little kids. And the parents were there, and it was little bitty boys and little girls, you know, wearing that Klan stuff. And the parents were carrying guns. They were carrying guns. And they were burning their cross and doing all this junk that they do. But those little kids were right there watching it, you know. And, you know, the police never bother those people. And I want to get back to I talked before about what had happened in Greensboro when the Klan came and killed people and wounded people and got away with it, you know, in the trials. They were let off. Nothing happened to them. But one of my friends lived in Greensboro that I had met he was telling me about what happened about a month after that. The Klan had a picnic, and they were passing around pictures of the autopsy of the guys that they had killed at the anti-Klan rally in March. They had the autopsy pictures of those folks, and the only way they could have got them is through the city government and the police. So there's, you know, there's a really close connection between the police and the Klan down there, and there still is. There still is. And I just remember that. And when he was saying that they passed around those pictures of the autopsy of those people, I was going to read some letters. You know, getting letters in Vietnam was so important. It was really our way of, you know, keeping in contact with our parents and our sisters and our brothers and family and friends. And it was, I mean, we didn't get a lot of, you know, when the helicopters came out to bring the ammo and the food, you know, the sea rations and stuff, and sometimes I'd bring out these bags of letters, and the lieutenant would go through them and get, you know, the letters for people in his platoon, and then he'd give the letters to the platoon leader, and he'd break them down, and then he would give them to each squad. And it was really, really nice, you know, getting a letter from home. It was really important. And I always felt bad for the guys that didn't get a lot of letters, you know. Some of those guys, you know, may not have had families. And a lot of the guys, you know, whenever we would get, somebody would get a package and it had cookies in it or whatever, we, you know, we'd pass them around. Everybody shared in it, you know. And it was just like this, we were, you know, we watched each other's backs and you know, took care of each other. And it was, you know, in Vietnam, at later in the war, there were race riots, you know. There was, in LBJ, at Long Bin Jail, there was race riots in Long Bin Jail, the folks in the prison there, the jail there, you know, started part of it on fire. And it was definitely the racial problems in Vietnam between the blacks and the whites. And it was pretty terrible. You know, my buddies that, the black buddies I had, you know, pretty much stayed out of it. But boy, there were some problems, you know, some problems, and that's really a sad thing. And we're, you know, that we're all there together, that we shouldn't be fighting amongst ourselves. And you get these Southern boys down there and in there, and they bring their racism with them, and that's really a problem. And today, even today, you know, there are Nazis and Klansmen in the military, and one of them just got kicked out of the Marine Corps. You know, he got it when they did the march on Charlottesville. There was pictures taken of him, and some people recognized him, and he was a Marine. And the Marine Corps was contacted, and he was court-martialed, and he spent some time in jail there, and they kicked him out. And the Marine Corps says, we have no room, you know, in the Marine Corps for racist or this kind of stuff, you know. But there, you know, there's a lot of them in there, and they get good training. You know, those groups, they train, you know. I'm sure the Proud Boys do it, and I'm sure that prayer group does it. You know, they have training where they learn to box and learn to do other things. So, you know, they're preparing themselves for a fight, and they come here to Portland, and you know, they're ready for a fight. And if, you know, if they get the chance, they're going to do it. There were even scuffles downtown, you know, after their so-called rally was over, between our, you know, it was a good thing Antifa was there, you know, to you know, help folks get out when they were going to be attacked by these people, these Nazis. You know, Antifa was there, you know. People have to realize that these people are violent. They're violent, and I went through it in the South. But I'm going to read a couple things here that I want to read. It's a letter, some letters home. And this is a letter that one guy wrote home. He says, "Hello, my darling. Here I am sitting down to write of my love for you and the horrors of war. Right now, I am pretending that I am talking to you. I can picture your face in front of me and our home and our children. Oh, how much the things we take for granted can mean so much. The smell of cut grass, the wind blowing over the lake and making trees and grass sway. The smell of autumn, the bareness of the world during winter. All of this means so much, and how little it is applauded. In the morning, I put on my field gear, my web belt with ammunition, hand grenades, smoke grenades, first aid pouch, canteen. Then I put two bandoliers of ammunition around my neck so that crosses on my chest. Then comes the pack containing poncho liner, 5C ration meals, rain jacket, sweatshirt, extra canteens, extra ammo, gun cleaning kit, smoke grenade, extra bolt for my rifle, a camera, and some cigarettes. Then I pick up my weapon, put on my helmet. With that on, I call my squad leaders and explain what my plan for the day is based on what the captain passes down to me. Mud, I never knew how much mud I could hate. We live in mud and rain. I'm so sick of rain that it's in sometimes unbearable. At night, the mosquitoes plague me while I'm lying on the ground with my poncho wrapped around me, and the rain drops on me until I go to sleep. The rain continues day after day until one wonders how much of the human body can stand. And yet it is my job, and I do it willingly, knowing that war is a constant factor in this world and has been since the beginning of man. There is something that keeps us fighting past the time when we feel like quitting. We go in tomorrow for sure. Everyone's morale is high, including me. I'm looking forward to getting clean and relaxed. Most of my men will be drunk as lords by tomorrow night. That should be some mail for me. I surely hope some letters mean a lot. You know something, honey? I love you lots and lots. Only you know how much. I'll write when we can. With love, Fred. And Fred was killed 2 weeks after he wrote this letter home. He was killed. It's another letter. This was written last will and testament of PFC Edward E. Marks, December 12, 1965. I am writing this in the event that I am killed during my remaining tour of duty in Vietnam. First thing of all, I want to say that I am here as a result of my own desire. I was offered a chance to go to the 2nd Marine Division when I was first assigned to the 4th Marines, but I turned it down. I am here because I always wanted to be a Marine. I don't like being over here, but I am doing the job and the job must be done. I am fighting an inevitable enemy that must be fought now or later. I am fighting to protect and maintain what I believe in and what I want to live in, a democracy. If I am killed while carrying out this mission, I want no one to cry or mourn for me. I want people to hold their heads high and to be proud of me for what job I've done. There are some details I want taken care of. First of all, any money that you receive as a result of my death, I want distributed in the following manner. If you are single, I want you and Sue to split down the middle. But if you are married and your husband can support you, I want Sue and Lenny to get 75% of the money, and I want you to keep 25%. I feel Sue and Lenny will need the money a lot more. I also want to be buried in my Marine uniform with all the decorations, medals, and badges I rate. I also want Rabbi Hitchberg to officiate, and I want to be buried in the same cemetery as Dad and Gramps. But I do not want to be buried in the plot next to Dad that I bought in mind of you. That is about all, except I hope I never have to use this letter. I love you, Mom and Sue and Nan, and I want you all to carry on and be happy and above all proud. Love much, Rick. Private PFC Rich Marks,
grew up in New York City, served in Vietnam with Company C, 1st Battalion, 3rd Regiment, 4th Marine Division, which operated in I Corps, which up on the DMZ. On February 14, 1966, 2 months after he wrote this letter, he was killed. He was only 19 years old. And as I go through this book and these letters, in 65, 66, they're pretty happy about, you know, being there and everything. But as the war, as the other guys come in the war, gets worse and worse, their letters aren't so happy, you know. They're not very happy. And here's a short letter that a guy wrote home. It's not very long. We're all scared. One can easily see this emotion in the eyes of each individual. One might hide it with his mouth, while another might hide it with his actions, but there is no way around it. We are all scared. They say when fear is in a man, he is preparing for it. When fear possesses the man, he is prepared for nothing. As of now, I fear is in me. I hope I can keep it from possessing me. This is from the journal written by PFC William A. McGuire Jr. of Short Hills, New Jersey, who died on September 1969, 2 days after contacting fever while on patrol in the DMZ. He was 20 years old, and he only had 4 weeks left to be in Vietnam. And as we go farther into the later years, the letters get more and more unhappy and more angry with the war. And they write poems too. A lot of the guys wrote poems, and some of them were pretty nice, and some of them weren't very nice, you know, that really unhappy. Okay, where's this one I wanted to read? I can't find it. I had it marked, and then I dropped my book, and I lost it. Oh, here's one. Here it is. This is in 69. We only got 7 minutes, so. They think the enemy went back into Cambodia to get resupplied, and that he's on his way back. There's talk in the 299th moving again, but they've been talking about it for a couple of months now. The politics behind all this monkey business around here is insane. The gradual withdrawal is going to cause more damage than good, and there becomes less and less GIs over here, and it means that the guys still here will depend on the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. I would not want to have to depend on... depend on the Arvin, it's called Arvin's Army of Vietnam, for anything. I don't see how we ever want a war if we are fighting the same way that they fought World War II. Maybe we will leave soon after all. George was a E4. George Ewing Jr. served in Vietnam with Company D, 299th Engineer Battalion, between January 69 and January 7, and he was killed at Dock Tho. We only got a few minutes left here, and I want to say, if you support KBOO, then support my show and Ani and everybody else's show, go onto the website, kboo.fm, and the upper right-hand corner is donations. And for donations, we can keep our radio station going, and we can help our brothers and sisters. So we'll be back on September 24th at 9 a.m., and there it is.
Love is but a song we sing, fears we will die.
may come and some may go. He will surely pay his. When the one that left us here returns for us at last, we are but a moment's sunlight fading in the grass. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together.
On Thursday, August 31st at 8 p.m. to celebrate the queer programmers and the queer community of KBOO as part of our 50th anniversary. Emma Lugo of Transpositive will host this special on-air program. You can join us that night at the Queer Community Open House here at KBOO at 20 Southeast Avenue from 7 to 10 p.m. on August 31st. More information about the Queer Community Open House and anniversary programming is available at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Valley Views, they talk to the director of STEM Academy at Oregon State University about efforts to provide access to science and technology to underrepresented groups.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Mountain Valley Jazz Festival on Saturday and Sunday, August 18th and 19th at Portland Metro Arts in Portland. Now in its fifth year, the Mountain Valley Jazz Festival showcases original jazz from Portland's eccentric and vibrant jazz scene. Performers this year include Randy Porter Trio with Nancy King, Nicole Governor Quartet, Farnell Newton, the Creative Music Guild, Sound Fundry, and many more. Again, the Mountain Valley Jazz Festival is on Saturday and Sunday, August 18th and 19th at Portland Metro Arts, 9003 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community.
Support for KBOO programming comes from Darkside Cinema, open every night featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes are available online at darksidecinema.com.